Welcome to a podcast of The Mike Novak Show. You can listen to Mike live Sunday mornings from 9 to 11 Central on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. Live from the beautiful Showcase Studios on South Pulaski Road, just across the street from the 53A bus stop and in between Paco's Tacos and Zaka Tacos, it's The Mike Novak Show, Chicago's only locally broadcast green, gardening, and environment program. Heard every Sunday right here on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes. And true currents and thriving seas. Wind blowing through breathing trees. Strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find. Good planets are in the main.
This hour of the Mike Novak Show is brought to you by The Care of Trees, our business's people and their love for trees, and by Sid's Greenhouses, Chicagoland's premier garden centers, and by WRD Environmental, creating sustainable landscapes for today and tomorrow. If he's a Renaissance man, I'm a Madonna and child with eggplants. Here he is, Mike Novak.
Because Mike Novak isn't here. So who's this strange voice you're hearing on the radio? I am Beth Botts. I'm the substitute host for Mike Novak. You may have heard of me as a garden writer or speaker. I have a story in the Chicago Tribune today. I'm a senior editor at Chicagoland Gardening Magazine, Master Gardener, all that stuff. And I'm sitting in for Mike Novak today because he is off Christmas caroling.
Yeah, he's singing.
It must be nice.
To not have to trek through the frozen tundra and just go sing all day long.
I think he has to trek through the frozen tundra in order to sing.
I think he actually has to go farther than normally, too.
He's somewhere on the roads. We hope he's driving slowly with his headlights on because it's really bad out there.
Yeah, be careful, folks. So I hope if you're out on the roads today, just be careful.
Just be careful. Mike is on his way up to the Chicago Botanic Garden with his group, the Frozen Robins, which sings Christmas carols. And I'm going to put a plug in here for Mike because he and the Frozen Robins have a clip of them singing O Rahm, O Rahm Emmanuel, which is on Mike Novak's website at mikenovak.net. That's Mike Novak with a W.
Yes.
.net.
It's also on YouTube and up on the Facebook, too.
It is. And the thing about this is Mike is trying really, really hard to get enough clicks, enough views of this video in order to try and get the giant megalopoly of Google to want to share revenue with him. He has high hopes for this, so... If you want to go and look at that video, it's actually kind of funny.
Oh, it's very funny. And they did it live in studio, and I was so glad I was off mic because my laughter would have drowned out the singing because it was so much fun.
Yes.
Well, they are talented folks.
Yes. And you know, if you want to help Mike make, you know, half a penny from Google or something, go and listen to the video. It's a video clip.
A parody of O Come Emmanuel to O Rahm Emmanuel.
Yes, it is. And we're actually here to talk mainly about gardening and nature today. We're on Twitter at Mike Now.
Yes.
Is Mike Novak's Twitter feed. My Twitter feed is Chicago Gardener. And my blog is growinginchicago.com. And various links for things that we will be talking about today are to be found in various posts on my blog at growinginchicago.com. Among the people we have today with us is Steve Sullivan, who is the curator of urban ecology at the Peggy Notabert Nature Museum, Chicago Academy of Sciences. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Beth. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, Steve's right here in the studio with us today. And we're going to talk, among other things, about squirrels, a lot of squirrels around. We're seeing a lot of squirrels. I even saw squirrels this morning. They weren't hunkered down.
Not yet.
Gardeners know squirrels pretty well. There's even, I think, possibly a little hostility among gardeners toward squirrels, mainly on the issues of tomatoes and crocus bulbs and things like that. So Steve's going to talk to us about that in addition to the fascinating natural history of squirrels and other subjects. We're going to talk about houseplants first, however. We're going to have a little chat about how you care for your houseplants in the wintertime. I have a large collection of houseplants that spend the summer on the patio, and then they come up into my living room in the winter, and they cluster around one of the few available windows, which unfortunately faces due north. So none of my houseplants actually has optimal habitat in the wintertime, and the natural result of this is that they start to sort of gradually die off. I've already had the first casualty. I had a cyclamen that bit the dust. It was sort of small, and it was tucked in among this other big cluster of much larger houseplants, and I kind of forgot its existence and failed to water it, and it died. But, you know, fundamentally, clustering your houseplants in a big group is a good idea, because it's sort of they kind of create a zone of humidity for each other. The water that evaporates from the soil and from the saucers of the houseplants kind of rises up around the foliage of the leaves and evaporates around the leaves and creates a little bit of a zone of higher humidity, and that's important for your houseplants in the wintertime because it's so dry in our houses. And that is a good tip. If you have houseplants and it's possible to cluster them in one place, that's a good idea. And of course, ideally, the cluster would be not near the radiator, because that's really tough on houseplants.
So putting them by the radiator is bad.
Putting them by the radiator is bad.
That's good to know.
And hey, Heather, listen, let's discuss your houseplants, because I seem to recall that the last time I was on this show, in like sometime in the fall, you were actually the recipient of some surplus.
I was. Lucky me.
It was a spider plant and a Chinese evergreen, as
yes.
I recall.
And there's another one sprouting up around the Chinese evergreen. It looks like a little like patch of ivy or something. This little green, and it's cool, and it's like filling in around the edges of the pot. So I was very excited. I'm like, bonus!
Okay, well, you know, if we were a florist, we would call that a mixed container.
Exactly.
But if it were in the garden, we would call it a weed. And since you like it, we'll call it a volunteer.
Yeah, we like it. We like
okay.
it. It's pretty.
And it's a volunteer.
It's all viney and green, and it's hanging over the side of the pot, and it's real pretty. And
it's probably Boston ivy, because I have a Boston ivy reseeding all over my garden, including in the pots.
Probably. And he's leaning toward the light. He really makes a reach for it, or she, or whatever, the plant.
They do that.
Yeah. And it's, but he I love it. So I rotate the pot, so the
good
leaves
idea.
Are all grow. And I'm like turning the pots every morning.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I'm catching on to this whole green thumb thing. I might only have a thumbnail at this point.
Yeah.
We're working on the whole thumb, but I haven't killed one yet.
Yeah. So, Steve, talk to me a little bit about this plant thing. And when the plants lean toward the light, they're not actually stretching toward the light. They're actually only putting on new cells on one side of the stem, right? Is that how that works?
Yeah, they're actually leaning away from the dark, really.
Really?
Yeah. And it's light-induced hormone movements, essentially, and that way they can, in effect, tip towards the light, and that lets their solar cells, their leaves, be more exposed to the sun, so they can make more sugars and grow more, of course.
Cool. So there's natural history even of houseplants.
Oh, houseplants are totally awesome as far as natural history, because you were talking about, is it a weed? Is it a volunteer? So not only do you get random plants popping up in your pots, especially if you let them stay outside over the summer, but, of course, we've all suffered with spider mites, fungus gnats. If you overwater, especially this time of year, your house is going to be full of insects. This should be the insect-free time of year. Well, not if you don't treat your houseplants right.
All right. Well, to talk to us about houseplants, we have Gene Bragdon from Lurvie's Landscape Supply and Garden Center in Des Plaines. On Gene 1, you there, Gene?
Sure am. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm great. And you're safe indoors. You have not been driving.
I did drive to get to work, but yes, I'm safe, safe here and warm.
Okay, well, we wanted to talk to you a little bit about sort of houseplant care in the winter and see what kind of recommendations you have for what people can do to help their houseplants get through the winter. The houseplants, you know, it's not kind of so obvious, but they do go dormant, don't they?
Well, not so much dormant, but they do slow down to a point because there's so much less light. The days are shorter. The light is not as intense, and so you're not seeing a whole lot of growth. And they're not as vigorous, so they don't need as much attention as perhaps they do when they're outside or in the spring and summer.
So what does that mean in terms of, like, watering?
Watering... really, you want to water, you know, each plant has their different needs, but since they're not growing as quickly, they're going to be needing water less often. But then, on the other hand, if your house is typically very dry and low in humidity, they may dry out a little bit faster. So it's...
So the basic thing would be you actually have to check your houseplants to see if they need watering.
You do, and you want to check regularly. One example would be we'd have a string of cloudy days, and you check the soil is, you know, it's still fairly moist, and all of a sudden we have a sunny day, and in 3 or 4 hours, all of a sudden your plant could show signs of wilting because it was right on the edge, but you couldn't tell. So you want to stay in tune with what your plants are doing and the weather.
Okay. Now, what I do with my houseplants is basically I just take my finger and I feel the soil. I know that there are a lot of people who seem to be reluctant to do that. And there are these sort of electronic moisture sensor things. What do you think of those?
Well, I have mixed emotions about them. You know, I think you need, if you're willing to get in tune with houseplants, you need to do whatever gets you there. Personally, I'd like to rely on your sense of feel and getting in tune with the plant. But the moisture meters, a lot of times they're just reading your salt level in the soil. But if it gets you started and it's working, go with it.
Okay. And not all plants need the same amount of moisture. I mean, if you have a snake plant, it's not going to need watering anywhere near as often as Heather's spider plant will, right?
Correct. There's plants can be almost put in groups. A lot of times it's like, when in doubt, and you could get certain plants that when in doubt don't water, when in doubt water, where certain plants would like to be more on the moist side, certain plants could just, they're like camels, they can just go for days and weeks. And snake plant is a perfect example. It has a great storage capacity.
So that's one of the reasons you see it so often in like high-rise building lobbies and places like that, is because it's really one of those plants that can take almost anything. Because it's from Africa. I think it's from southern Africa, where it's really dry, and it's almost a desert plant, I think.
It almost is, and I do believe it is from Africa. But those plants are wonderful. They can take cool temperatures in the evening and during the day. They don't grow very fast. So when you do see them, they're a little pricier than some of the other plants because they take, you know, quite a while to get sizable. And they're low maintenance. They don't need a whole lot of care. And, you know, they used to be everywhere. I know my mother had, you know, mother-in-law's tongue. She, oh, everybody knows that plant. And then it kind of wasn't trendy for a while, and now they're making a comeback.
Well, I think they're breeding a bunch of different cultivars of the snake plants and with that have, you know, are shorter, or they have different variegation, or they have a slightly different color of green. So there's a little more variety maybe available in the snake plants than there used to be. So what about fertilizing for houseplants in the wintertime? What should you be fertilizing? Is that a good idea? Or should you just, like, let it go as long as they're growing so slowly?
Well, if your plants are growing, sometimes, you know, all of us, when it comes down to fertilizer, it's what we're comfortable with. When you, outside, do we fertilize with every watering? Do we fertilize maybe once a month much stronger? Do we put in time release? So it's where you're comfortable with, but because the plants are, you know, not really vigorous, if you're the person who does a little bit with every watering, it's okay. You're certainly not going to over-fertilize them. But if you don't, my personal favorite is just kind of doing some time release little mm-hmm. pellets when fall sets in, or I'm bringing them in from the outdoors, and then it does the work for me. I don't have to worry about, did I do too much? Did I not do enough? I personally think, you know, if you choose to back off, that would be fine until spring sets in, the days get longer, and there's a little bit more sunshine.
And then the other thing that Steve just raised a few minutes ago is the whole issue of pests. And overwatering, and I know one thing that gets to a lot of people is fungus gnats. I'm a little prone to that myself because I keep my houseplants inside in a plastic pot that's inside a sort of a decorative basket with a kind of saucer thing inside, and I often sort of fail to notice that I've allowed the saucer thing to fill with water, so the plant is actually sitting in a puddle of water. And the plants start to look really sickly because they look like they're wilting, they look like they're not getting enough water, but the actual problem is they're sitting in this sort of funky pond of water, and then the soil stays kind of wet and muddy and funky, and the next thing you know, I've got these little flying insects all over the place. And those are fungus gnats, right?
They are fungus gnats. If they're black, kind of like what you see around bananas and so forth.
Yeah.
If they're white, then you have a different insect.
And, you know, apart from obviously emptying the water out of the saucer every time you water your plants, what can you do about this? Is there any kind of benign way to control these insects?
Well, the insects, yes, and the watering, too, is how you set that up. But the insects can be controlled with, there's systemic granules. There's
okay.
some granules that you can sprinkle on the top of the soil. Smells a little chemical-y, so a lot of times I like to put, a handful of potting mix on top of it to keep the odor down, and water it in, and that will, you know, get into the soil. And the fungus gnats really are harmless; they're just annoying, and they mess with us a little bit. It's like, bugs are in my house.
Yeah.
So a lot of times the systemic granules will just take care of it right away. Another way is, they really only feed on moisture, so if you do let your plant get a little bit drier on the dry side, they have nothing to feed on.
Ah.
They like moisture. So back off on the watering, maybe use the systemic granules as well as a double dose, and, you know, you should be good to go.
Yeah, Steve, what?
You know, Beth, we have fungus gnat problems occasionally in places where we keep some of our live animals. And I think systemic fertilizers are the most effective, but sometimes you don't want those your right. animals exposed to that. So one thing we do that's relatively effective is we put as deep a layer of silica sand, like the builder's sand, not play sand, around the base of the plants. And some species aren't amenable to this, but that inhibits the growth of the larva a little bit, or the emergence of the larva.
So this is underneath the soil?
No, right on top. You just pour a half inch or so of sand, so the water's draining through, and the larva can't really live in that dry zone, and they can't burrow up through it very effectively.
So you're basically mulching your houseplants with this silica sand.
Fine sand, yeah. And it's the builder sand. It's the stuff that's like sugar. It just flows right through your fingers, and when it gets wet, it doesn't hold shape. Kids would hate it for sandboxes. That's the kind you need.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a really good idea. I have thought about maybe I should mulch my houseplants with something sort of decorative, but I'd much rather mulch them with something functional.
Sure.
So that's a really good tip. Gina, a couple weeks ago I had a story in the Tribune about ferns, which are, I think, particularly challenging for some people in Chicago houses in the wintertime. Do you have any advice to give people about ferns?
Well, yes. The ferns are one of those plants that really like humidity. If you had room in your bathroom, that would be great after the shower and so forth. And it's also one of the plants that, when in doubt, they like to be kept moist, more evenly moist than anything. So when in doubt, you want to water that plant as opposed to letting it get too dry, because they are quite fragile and they will show damage easily if not. So I recommend you can either mist them to get more of that humidity and...
But you'd have to do that, like, every day or twice a day or
oh,
something.
Oh, yes, yes. And that, you know, becomes a part-time job and, you know.
Yeah. So you may not want to.
You may not want to do that. It is possible to, if it's a smaller fern where it's sitting, you can get a larger saucer, maybe 15 inches across or something, put a little bit of gravel in there, and then just add a little bit of water and then set the fern on top of it, not so it's sitting in water, but so that the water can evaporate around the plant. It'll give it a little bit more humidity to combat it if you have a very dry house.
Okay, great. Well, listen, Jean, I want to thank you a lot. That's Jean Bragdon from Lurvies in Des Plaines. They're at lurvies.com. And I really appreciate your taking the time to talk to us on the radio today. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much.
This is the Mike Novak Show on WCPT 828 AM in Chicago. That's Chicago's progressive talk. It's the holiday season here. We're getting to crunch time. Your Christmas list is probably still half empty. You may be really wondering about what you're going to do about some people. But if you're listening to this show, you're probably a gardener. You probably know gardeners. There may be people on your Christmas list who are gardeners. And for them, there is a solution. Chicagoland Gardening Magazine. Six times a year, it is the garden magazine for our region, for Chicago, for the states around the southern end of Lake Michigan, Milwaukee to Saugatuck. This is your magazine, west of DeKalb. Regional reports from all the greater Chicagoland area, great information, articles about basically gardening anywhere in Zone 5. And the reason you know that this is an extremely, exceptionally fine magazine is that, first of all, Mike Novak writes a humor column in every issue six times a year. And secondly, I personally am a senior editor at Chicagoland Gardening Magazine. I have a story about organic fertilizers in the November-December issue and a bunch more stuff coming up in the January-February issue. And so I can personally vouch for the quality of the information in this magazine. You'll find tips. You'll find the Chicago area's best list of gardening events. And you'll find expert advice from in answer to garden questions. It's really worthwhile. And so the thing about it is it's really easy to do because you can go right on the website at chicagolandgardening.com. You can subscribe your friend, and then you just print out the website, and you put it in a nice card, and you hand it to people on Christmas morning. And you can do this at 11:45 on Christmas Eve, and you will have given your gardener friend a great Christmas present. So, subscribe to Chicagoland Gardening Magazine. You can call 888-265-3600, 888-265-3600, or go to chicagolandgardening.com.
Spending more time at home these days? Give yourself some room. Renovate your basement or attic. You'll increase your living space and your home's resale value, too.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for your remodeling needs, including additions, renovations, and other home improvements. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
This is the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk. And with Christmas just about 12 days away, you'd better make that list and check it twice, at least twice. Then count on the folks at Sid's Greenhouses and Garden Center to help you get through it with a great, great gift, plus home and party decor. Everyone's been disappointed by a discount store poinsettia. And that's right, folks, I say poinsettia. So this year, be sure to get a real florist quality poinsettia from Sid's Greenhouses. They deliver throughout the entire Chicagoland area. And in addition to poinsettias, they also have the best custom made to order floral gifts in Chicago and Chicagoland for that matter. And so much more. So get your list of family, friends, and business associates together today. Call SIDS tomorrow, and it's done. SIDS can also help with home party decorating. Fresh Christmas centerpieces will add a special touch to your holiday table. Plus, SIDS' entire stock of lifelike Christmas trees, decorations, and ornaments is 50 to 75% off this week. That's right, 50 to 75% off. Fresh cut trees, wreaths, and garland are still available, and they're the real eco-friendly alternative for holiday decorating. SIDS, Chicagoland's premier garden centers are located in Palos Hills on Southwest Highway and in Bolingbrook on Napier Plainfield Road at Hassert Boulevard.
On WCPT 820 AM in Chicago. This is Beth Bott substituting for Mike Novak because he is off Christmas caroling somewhere. We're here with Steve Sullivan from the Peggy Notabart Nature Museum, and he's here actually to talk about squirrels, about which we have not said one word yet, but we will right after we go to Rick DeMaio for the weather. Rick, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Beth. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, you know, I was up at Northbrook Mall yesterday, and I think in the parking lot it says a couple of squirrels wearing North Face jackets. Is that possible?
Yeah.
I've seen even underwear for squirrels, so you never know what they're wearing these days.
Yeah, they got a little bit better there up on the North Shore. We got to do something about that.
So Rick, we have some like weather out there today.
Like weather?
That.
Oh my God, Beth, you could do a little bit better job than that. This is about as bad as it gets around here. We're talking, we're pretty much talking near blizzard conditions moving through.
Yeah. Well, I both Heather and I were driving to the studio this morning, and in our separate cars, we both had windshield wiper failures.
Oh, that's not good.
No, it was quite awful, actually.
Yeah, that's when you open up your sunroof and you reach over with your right hand while you're holding the steering with your left hand. You just kind of go from left to right. So,
mumbling like mumbling obscenities under your breath.
Yes.
Yeah, that you already probably started doing. So now what happened? Was the windshield wiper mechanism not working, or was it just the fluid that you kind of ran out of?
Well, my windshield wiper blade is just sort of flapping.
I see.
And Heather's, I believe, came off completely.
No, it's hanging on by one screw at this point. It's sort of jackknifed, like flopping, same thing. So I turned them off. Luckily for me, it only happened about a block away from the studio.
Yeah. But the problem is now you have to drive home, and the weather right now is probably not even something that you want to even deal with in a car, even if you have good windshield wipers.
There's
right
like
now.
A little sort of Jiffy Lube-esque auto place up the road here, and I'm praying to God they're open on Sunday.
Yeah,
thank God for the 24/7 life.
It's like, please.
Yeah, but what we have going on right now, Beth, it's kind of an interesting storm system. When this area of low pressure basically occluded, which means that it didn't have a chance to develop any further, generally north of the line from like Waukegan to Milwaukee, once it moved east of us and the wind turned around to the north, the temperature this morning, I don't know if you noticed it, but it actually jumped about 10 degrees in about an hour. We had a little burst of rain, and now the lake enhanced and backside system snow is moving through. And this is pretty much about as bad as it ever gets in Chicago. We have winds anywhere between 30 and 40 mile per hour sustained gusts. I should say sustained winds with gusts probably up to about 45 to 50 miles per hour. And wave heights on Lake Michigan, if you really care about that, probably running around 8 to 12 feet. And probably a fairly good swath of 2 to 4 inches of what we call lake enhanced snow. It's not so much lake effect, but generally the moisture coming in off the lake is mixing in with some of this cold air, producing some lake effect snow. It's actually not going to be cold enough for lake effect snow here, but it'll be cold enough, say, north of Waukegan and eventually across northwestern sections of Indiana later on tonight, and for sure across north central areas of Indiana during the day on Monday and Tuesday. So if anybody is traveling eastbound on I-90 or 80 or 94 from Chicago into northern Indiana, Michigan later on this afternoon, I think the roads will probably become impassable sometime after about 6 or 9, 8 o'clock. This is going to be a very significant storm system for there. But here probably just going to be 2 to 4 inches of snow, and I think by about 8 or 9 o'clock tonight, most of the snow is over, and the cold winter locks in at that point, Beth.
Okay, so if you're driving, this is really bad news.
But if you put it this way, if you're driving and you're listening to us, you don't need for us to be telling you it's really bad news. This is about as bad as it gets. Well, the interesting thing about it is if you're driving south, it's probably not so bad because the snow and wind is coming from the north. But if you're driving due north, it's basically hitting you right in the windshield. So 40 to 50 mile per hour winds with half-mile visibility. We're getting pretty close to near blizzard conditions, and I wouldn't be surprised if for about a 2 to 3 hour period of time, most of the area observations are reporting visibility generally about a quarter of a mile or so and winds over 30 miles per hour, which is really all you need for a blizzard because you don't really need snow accumulating. All you need is the horizontal visibility reduced by the snow and the wind as well. But what's going to be really amazing is when the Bears begin to play at about 3:15.
Yeah.
Obviously, the game starts during the daytime, but by the time they're in halftime, the lights are on, and any snow that's falling looks oh so much worse than those stadium lights. And I would love to see how far someone can kick the ball, either punt it or kick off from the south end of the end, from the south end of the field to the north end of the field. You're going to see the ball literally go up about 10 or 20 yards and then come straight back.
Or completely get blown back 4 yards from where it was punted.
Oh, yeah, that.
Yeah. I've seen that, actually, in the rain. I've seen that at Soldier Field.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Now, old Soldier Field was actually much, much worse as far as the wind was concerned because the stadium didn't have as much height to it. It was pretty much like an open pit. But this field, there's a lot less wind that gets down onto the field. Now, granted, it's still kind of swirly, but the old Soldier Field, it was more open, so obviously the wind actually played more of a factor. But for anybody going to the game today or even venturing, trying to get to the game, it's kind of a shame because these are two really, really good teams playing a very, very good game and or potentially could be, and the weather's going to be, you know, in a factor 100% of the time.
Yeah.
Well, maybe this is just the test that really
challenges
these teams and sorts out.
All I know is that Minnesota would take the conditions at Old Soldier Field right now, wouldn't they?
They would, because the Vikings stadium, the Metrodome, actually collapsed this morning. So they have much worse stadium problems than the Bears
do. Yeah, the roof definitely had some problems. But
there was 20 inches of snow and ice accumulated on it, something like 17, 20 inches, and down. When they said, I heard one report said it looked like a collapsed souffle.
Yeah, that's probably it. That's probably pretty much what it looked like. But yeah, it's interesting, Beth. You know, we were talking to Mike early last week about how we had the two different systems of moderate to heavy rain coming through before we had the cold weather. And so far, for the first 10 days of the month of December, temperatures are averaging about 8 to 9 degrees below normal.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the ground has really frozen up quite a bit, particularly with the subsoil moisture now being sufficient. But prior to that, we were basically in near drought conditions. So the rain that we had in that last week of November really, really helped out. And now that we're getting this layer of snow, anything that was planted or anything that had their roots into that subsoil moisture on the 1st of December are going to do really well, because when temperatures falling back into the single digits late tonight and staying in the teens for Monday and Tuesday, just about any moisture that's in the ground is going to be locked in and is not going to evaporate into any cold air. So even though it's pretty nasty right now from a standpoint of humans and squirrels, I think the plants going into the wintertime are going to do pretty well.
Well, that's good. And I have spread enough leaves on my garden, and I'm really crossing my fingers and hoping and hoping and hoping that between the leaves and this snow layer, we're going to get my ground remains unfrozen for me to plant the tulip bulbs that I still have not yet planted.
No, I don't think that's going to happen.
That's not what I wanted to hear, Mike.
I think you kind of waited a little bit too long on that one, Beth. Yeah, wait until maybe early April. That'll be it. Maybe late March. But I think we're done. In fact, we could see another significant snow come through here Wednesday, and then again late Saturday. So the pattern has definitely turned cold and snowy. And I don't think we're going to see any thaw whatsoever around here for probably a good solid 2 weeks. So winter is here, and winter is here to stay.
Well, nuts.
Yeah.
Can I say nuts on the radio?
Yes, you can.
Yeah, you just did it.
So what's our forecast looking like there, Rick?
Well, obviously, we're on the winter storm warning today, Heather, with I'd say anywhere about 2 to 4 inches of snow, about 4 inches east of 294, Edens, Dan Ryan, up to the lakefront, probably about 4 inches. It's going to be really difficult to measure. But I think the best chance, believe it or not, it's kind of a weird setup. The best chance for 4 inches is probably north of Waukegan, and then south, basically, of Hyde Park. Right along the Chicago shoreline, we may kind of get skirted with about 3 inches, about 2 inches further west, and then east of Gary, Indiana, probably about 6 inches, eastern sections of Lake County, probably about 8 inches, and from Valparaiso, which is in eastern Porter County, out to LaPorte County, I wouldn't be surprised to see as much as 20 inches of snow, of lake effect snow, by the time this system is done, maybe by Tuesday morning, or maybe even by Tuesday afternoon. This is going to be about a 48 to about 60-hour long event. So this is going to be a significant, significant snowfall for the counties generally east of Chicago. Tonight, though, temperatures get down to about 5 above. Wind chills probably about 15 to 25 degrees below zero. So obviously a big challenge tomorrow morning. One thing I'm really going to warn people of is before you go to bed, go out and chip some of that ice and snow off your windshield and then try to get into your car. Because I've seen what happens with this before, Beth and Heather, is that you get this warm-up, you get this rain, and then it gets really cold. And you see people trying to get into their car in the morning, and then they may get in, but the lock is frozen. They can't close the door. So now you're trying to drive and text at the same time, and while you're trying to hold your door shut because the lock is frozen. So make sure you get out tonight and check on the locks. And then tomorrow, a lot of sunshine, actually. Windy, cold, high temperature, maybe 15, wind chills about 10 to 15 below zero. And an overnight low probably not getting below zero until Tuesday morning. We need the wind to drop down a little bit. So 15 for a high up Tuesday, cloudy and then with some snow redeveloping Wednesday, high temperature about 25. This looks like maybe a 2 to 4 inch event, and then Thursday, Friday staying cold but dry temperatures in the 20s. So snow today, windy. This is about as cold and windy as it gets on a scale of 1 to 10. 1 being bad and 10 being, I should say 1 being good and 10 being bad. This is probably about 11. So this is about as bad as it gets, Heather and Beth.
Okay.
Chicago-sicle. Yeah.
Chicago. Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Rick. That was Rick DeMaio with the weather. And if you want to find more good forecasting from a guy who knows his gardening, it's at DeMaioWeather.com.
And have a good day, Beth.
You too. Stay warm. This is Beth Bott sitting in for Mike Novak on the Mike Novak Show. And I have here with me Steve Sullivan, who is the curator of urban ecology at the Peggy Notaubert Nature Museum of the Chicago Academy of Sciences. And the reason I asked Steve here today is because I want to talk about squirrels. Steve is knows a lot about a whole lot of animals, but he especially knows about squirrels. And what are the squirrels doing this time of year?
Well, as Rick pointed out a second ago, the weather was a little bit warm this morning, so squirrels were out foraging and doing your average squirrely thing, digging up nuts and eating and maybe shaking a little snow off their coats, but they were plenty warm. Now, as the wind starts to pick up and it gets more blizzardy here, squirrels are going to go hang out in little crevices in trees, maybe in the soffits of your house or your garage, and just try to stay warm and out of the wind. But interestingly, tree squirrels, the ones that we see running around our yards most of the time, are not hibernating. They might just skip a day or two when it's too cold and be a little hungry, but be warm and tight in their beds.
So they're out there, they're hustling.
That's right.
They're hustling for a meal. Yeah. They're hustling in the garbage cans. They're trying to find the things they buried a few weeks ago, and it's actually one of the things the snow is gonna do for us. It's gonna keep the squirrels from eating our bulbs, right?
Well, yes and no. squirrels have these wonderfully sharp grappling hooks on the ends of their toes that they use to climb up and down trees, and it helps them dig through the frozen soil to get bulbs too. So squirrels are really, really going to prefer to eat nuts, acorns and hazelnuts and things like this. But when it starts to get later in the winter, once they've exhausted their food supplies, if they have to go for your bulbs as one of those last resort foods, even if they're buried relatively deep and frozen in the soil, they'll probably give it a go.
And is there anything that that you can do to prevent this? You and I had a conversation earlier when you described to me a strategy that you had that was sort of a combination of misdirection and bribery.
That's right. Well, yeah, we can go through the seasons. You know, we'll say in the fall when you're hopefully planting your tulips, if it's not too late, crocuses, yeah, daffodils, things like this. The way I do it, since I have both gray squirrels and fox squirrels in my yard, I'll usually plant one side of the yard first, so maybe start in the backyard, and I will turn up all of that soil, not just the spot where I want to bury the bulb, because when we turn up the soil, we smell that wonderful fresh soil smell. That's the nitrobacter that are living in the soil, and squirrels will cue in on that. They know that where they smell that, there's something buried, even if they can't smell the bulb, which they probably can do that also. So if you dig up your whole flower bed as much as you can, then you're dispersing that smell across the surface. Then plant your bulbs, and if you can, I like to put down 1/4-inch galvanized metal mesh just right over the top.
Okay.
And that's just kind of an extra fail-safe. I use that throughout my garden in various capacities. And then I'll dust it with a little bit of cayenne pepper or blood meal or some of these repellents. And then in the front yard, I will...
So this is a totally different part of your yard than the yard where you're planting the bulbs.
Right. So I've got the house as a barrier here. I've got the bulbs and all the gardening going on in the backyard. And then in the front yard, I'm buying off these hustling little squirrels. I throw peanuts and hazelnuts, and they love black walnuts, occasionally Brazil nuts. They take a while to get through. And so what this does is this encourages the squirrels to visit the front yard and to just leave the backyard alone, because why would you want to go to all the effort of trying to dig up a bulb when there's a wonderful nut just laying there on the ground for you? Now, you have to reach a balance, because if you overfeed the squirrels, that's just going to make them survive more, it's going to make them make more babies, and then you're going to have an extra pest presence in your yard. But if you can give them just enough nuts to keep them in the front yard while everything settles down in the backyard, then you can reverse the process, plant your front yard, bait the backyard, and then eventually, hopefully, you'll have a good number of flowers coming up, and the squirrels will have disturbed fewer of your bulbs than they would have under normal circumstances.
Yeah, because that's my personal strategy. My personal strategy is just to plant enough bulbs that I can spare a few for the squirrels.
Sure.
But I might try this more elaborate strategy next fall if I, as I hope to do, get started planting my bulbs a little bit earlier so that I can get it done before the blizzard. And I want to talk to Steve more about squirrels, especially about a project that he has going called Project Squirrel. But first we want to answer a question that came in about
Twitter.
Mites on ivy.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of lost track
Let me find it. Scroll down.
Here
it's
we are.
It's from Susan
Burke. We have Susan Burke.
On Twitter.
On Twitter, wanting to know about how she gets rid of mites on ivy. Well, I know what I'll do, what I would do. I would, basically, I'd give the ivy a bath would be the first thing. I'd get it out of the... If you have it in a decorative pot, I'd take it to the bathtub, put something on the bottom of the bathtub, like rags or something to protect the bottom of the bathtub, and give the ivy a really good bath, which will wash off a lot of the with the shower. You know, I mean, you're not immersing the plant in a bathtub full of water. You're washing it off with the shower. And that will get off a lot of plants, of pests that are sort of on the surface of the leaves. And then my next line of defense is insecticidal soap. I don't make up my home, a homemade potion of soap using dish soap or something. You'll see recipes like that on the internet. The problem with that is that some of those things, those solutions are really caustic and they can strip the protective coating off the leaves. So it's better to go to the garden center and get an insecticidal soap that's made for that purpose and then apply it according to the directions on the label. Steve, you have any other suggestions?
Every so often, I'll mist them with isopropyl alcohol because in some insects, I haven't done this to mites, but you do it to things with waxy cuticles. It'll destroy that waxy cuticle and injure the bug more than it will injure the plant. So you do it judiciously.
Yeah. So that's basically what we're all about. We're all about injuring the bug more than we injure the plant. I'm just going to take a minute here to talk about the Care of Trees, which is one of the sponsors of this show. Here's a tip from the Care of Trees. Actually, it's several ways that they give back to the Chicagoland community. They support organizations like the Open Lands Tree Keepers. I personally am about to become an official Open Lands Tree Keeper next Saturday. I will have my investiture ceremony, whatever they do. I don't know if it's like joining the Shriners and their secret ceremonies or something, but I completed the classes and I'm actually going to become an open lands tree keeper. The Care of Trees is a big supporter of tree keepers. Some of our speakers came from the Care of Trees. The Care of Trees shows up for every course and teaches average citizens how to make the urban forest healthier. The Care of Trees also works with the City of Chicago Department of the Environment's Green Corps, a job training program. Green industry program, which is run out of the Center for Green Technology. The Care of Trees speaks to garden clubs and teaches their members how to preserve the greatest plants on the planet. Okay, we're not going to get into that argument. These are just three reasons why you should make the Care of Trees your permanent partner in enhancing the value of your landscape. Whether you want to make sure all is well with the trees in your yard, you're changing your landscaping, or you're moving, invite the certified arborist at the Care of Trees to take a look. See thecareoftrees.com or call 847-394-4220. That's 847-394-4220. The Care of Trees, their business is people and their love for trees.
Hey gardeners, want to be inspired? Make plans to visit Cantini Gardens in Wheaton, the 500-acre former estate of Robert R. McCormick. Cantini isn't just beautiful, it's a horticultural masterpiece. Stroll through the spectacular formal gardens created by renowned landscape architect Franz Lipp and marvel at the sheer variety of annuals, perennials, ground covers, trees, and shrubs. You'll love Cantini's Idea Garden, Rose Garden, and Native Prairie too. Cantini has something for everyone, including museums, picnic area, gift shop, and restaurants. Plan your visit today at cantini.org.
tropicals and tree stands are 30% off at Grand Street Gardens this week. So wherever you stand on the holiday barometer, they've got you covered. And you can still get in the season with pre-made arrangements that feature assorted dried branches, evergreen highlights, pine cones, and berries. Perfect for centerpieces. And they have Fraser and Balsam firs, too. Perfect places for presents. Make your home grand for the holidays at Grand Street Gardens, open 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. during the week, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on the weekends, and located at 2200 West Grand Avenue. That's 2200 West Grand Avenue in the Ukrainian Village neighborhood of Chicago. Now, I understand that we have a squirrel question.
We do. We have from Dan in Chicago. He is on line one. Hold on. Let me get him going here. Yep. Dan, are you there?
Yeah, I am.
All right. Feel free to ask your question.
Okay, yeah. I wanted to ask you about some squirrel horror shows that I've watched. I'm a writer, and I work from the third floor, and I see the squirrels for about the last 17 years. And each generation, we had normal squirrels. This has to do with somebody coming in and overfeeding. But, you know, the baseline was that, you know, there were a mom and pop squirrel, and they had a baby, and they watched them build a nest. And that went on for several generations. And then when a woman down the, about four doors down, started putting out, you know, bushels of squirrel, I mean, over a day, four or five times, feeding the squirrels on our street, and somebody also did the same on the next street, it totally changed squirrel behaviors. First of all, they got big and fat, so a big fat squirrel would butt into the squirrel's nest. Also, the babies grew up. They had no idea. They were, after that generation was messed up, the babies had no idea how to build nests and would try to build them in the spring. And the third thing that happened was they got incredibly aggressive because they weren't hunting for food. They weren't building nests. And it would be like military maneuvers all day where they would get up in the trees and stalk each other out and go charging together. And I literally saw them fight in the middle of the top trees and fight off and fall down. And sometimes they got even aggressive on people.
Sure.
Did this strike a bell?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, if we take what you said and we take out squirrel and put in people, it's the script for a lot of movies. You know, it makes me think of The Time Machine with the Eloy and the Morlocks and things like this. And really that's exactly what's going on, is that an additional food supply has been provided so that more squirrels can survive, but at some point you reach what's called carrying capacity, the number of animals that can live in that environment. And then they've just got to fight for food, fight for space. The reason they're building leaf nests in the spring is because they've got to get out of their winter homes as quick as possible because they're so heavily utilized by other squirrels, they're so parasitized. And so really you're seeing sort of the equivalent of the apocalypse-type breakdown of society that we see in movies oftentimes.
Absolutely. And then the question, the other part of this is, what do I do about it? I mean, one of the things is rat control. It also attracts rats.
Sure.
It's hard to get the community to take a stand about it because the woman who's feeding them has about a 6'5" son who's really aggressive, like the squirrels. And one can wonder about that. So, what can you say about that?
Well, you know,
talking to them does no good whatsoever.
Yeah, and there are various ordinances that enforce the feeding of wildlife and things like that. But one of the main things that I find to help which is the reason that we've started Project Squirrel in large part, is we want everybody to start looking at the natural world with more of a sense of ecology and habitat and nature, not just, wow, those are cute little fuzzy things and I love them, or wow, those are pests and I hate them, but really, why are these animals doing what they're doing? And, you know, certainly you can't get through to everybody, but one of the things we've done with Project Squirrel is tried to design it so that people of all ages can participate. And we encourage people to do things like evaluate, do they have gray squirrels in their yards or fox squirrels? Gray squirrels, of course, are usually mostly gray with white bellies, although sometimes they're black.
Mm-hmm.
And then fox squirrels that have the rusty bellies, and they're usually, at least as adults, they're bigger than gray squirrels. Or do they have no squirrels in their yards? That's interesting data, too.
And Project Squirrel is there's actually a website where you can make, if you're a citizen, if you're a gardener, if you're somebody with a backyard in Chicago, you can actually make observations of what kind of squirrels you're seeing in your yard, whether they're gray squirrels or fox squirrels, what kind of behavior you're seeing from those squirrels. And then you can log this information on the website at projectsquirrel.org, right?
Yeah. Or com. We've got them all.
Okay.
And finally, what about the ordinances? I mean, how does one go about in a somewhat peaceful way to get these ordinances enforced in a case like this where it really gets out of control and somebody doesn't listen?
Yeah, that's oftentimes up to your local law enforcement, that can be difficult. But you know, call and tell the police department, and they'll pass it on to the right person to enforce it. But you know, maybe before that, print off the webpage to Project Squirrel and slip it in her mailbox, and maybe this will encourage her to look at her squirrels in a more scientific way. And a lot of times we have people contact us with, you know, hey, is this really healthy what I'm doing? And it sounds to me like what may be healthy for the squirrel individual may really not be healthy for the overall environment in the neighborhood. And, you know, looking at squirrels in a more scientific way might get her to see mm-hmm. some of these things.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot, Dan. We really appreciate your calling in.
You bet. Thank you. Yeah.
Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Steve, we have another question that I'll ask real quick from Scott Jameson, who is Chicago Tree MD on Twitter. And what he's asking is, do we have flying squirrels in Chicago?
We do have flying squirrels. Chicagoland is really a squirrel hotspot. Project Squirrel is monitoring just our two most common tree squirrels, the gray squirrel and the fox squirrel, primarily because they have a really interesting mechanism of coexistence that allows us to understand more about the habitat from a scientific standpoint.
Greetings, you culture bugs. Today's poem is called The Daffodils. I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils, continuous as the stars that... Hey!
Can't you read the sign, buddy?
Well, certainly. What sign?
The one behind those daffodils.
This one that says, do not pick flowers?
That's the one.
Well, there I was, Your Honor, wandering lonely as a cloud that floats...
Thirty daffodils, eh? That will be $30 and 30 days.
Now oft, when on my couch I lie in vacant or in pensive mood, they flash upon my bright blue eye as I sit here in solitude. And then my heart with anger fills. $1 apiece for daffodils?
This hour of the Mike Novak Show is brought to you by The Care of Trees, our business's people and their love for trees, and by Sid's Greenhouses, Chicagoland's premier garden centers, and by WRD Environmental, creating sustainable landscapes for today and tomorrow. Here he is again, Mike Novak.
Well, it isn't actually Mike Novak at all. It's Beth Botts subbing for Mike Novak today because Mike is off singing Christmas carols somewhere. And I personally would like to say in my own defense that although I did not get my tulips planted before the umpteen inches of snow, I did get my daffodils planted. So,
good. And I just want to say, apologize to you there. That's why we came in out of the bullwinkle from the flying squirrel comment. Mr. Michael Sanders was supposed to do some flailing for me to be my backup eyes for the start of the 10 a.m. news, and he failed to flail.
He failed to flail. So, okay. So it's everything is somebody else's fault.
Of course.
That's the most important thing.
Have you been listening to the show, haven't you?
Before we were so rudely interrupted by the news, Steve Sullivan from the Peggy Notabart Nature Museum, the curator of urban ecology there, was talking to us about squirrels and specifically about flying squirrels in the Chicago area.
Yeah. And I got to say, it's good that you got your daffodils planted because squirrels tend to avoid daffodils. And so you shouldn't have any squirrel problems this coming spring. And as I was saying, Chicago is a squirrel hotspot. So we have the gray squirrel with the white belly, the fox squirrel with the kind of rusty colored belly. We also have the largest squirrel in North America, the woodchuck. which is indeed a squirrel. And
okay, I'm going to trust you on that.
It's a rodent, and it's classified as a squirrel. We also have chipmunks, which are another kind of squirrel. And, of course, we have the flying squirrel. Now, the flying squirrels are nocturnal, so they're a little bit difficult to see, but a lot of our squirrely Project Squirrel observers report them in the comment section on our data sheet, so we know they're common throughout the region.
Okay, cool. Now, listen, about this Project Squirrel, this is something that is sort of generically referred to as citizen science, right?
Yeah.
And we have someone else on the phone right now who's involved in another citizen science project. This is Kay Havens, who's director of plant science and conservation at the Chicago Botanic Garden in Glencoe. But more importantly, for our purposes, she's one of the main forces behind Project Budburst, which is another citizen science project. Are you there, Kay?
I am.
First, I'm going to ask Steve to talk a little bit about Project Squirrel and how it operates exactly, and then I'm going to come back to you and ask you to talk a little bit about Project Budburst and what's going on with that.
Okay, sounds great.
So, Steve, tell us if I want to get involved in Project Squirrel, what exactly do I do?
Yeah, well, one of the things about citizen science is it's a way to utilize people on a broad region to get fine-scale observations in a way that a professional scientist simply can't do. And we find that people who get passionate about this kind of thing can report every bit as accurate data as can a professional scientist. And so that's why we've designed Project Squirrel the way we have. We could be looking at flying squirrels, for example, but tree squirrels are a little bit better for this kind of project. And so what we do is we encourage everybody once a season to go to the Project Squirrel website, at least once a season. You can go every day if you want, and report on what you see happening in your yard, your neighborhood, your workspace, anything like this. If you see a bunch of squirrels one morning, report them. If you don't see squirrels one morning, report that too, because absence of squirrels is just as important as presence of squirrels. And these observation activities are happening nationwide every day. We have observers from coast to coast, and they're telling us things that they think are common. You know, they'll see squirrels in their yard every day. Oh, this is normal. And indeed, in some places, that's really not normal from a historical context. Or in other places, they don't see squirrels, and they think that's normal. And in fact, that's kind of weird. And we put this nationwide data together, and we get really a very interesting picture of what's going on, especially in our urban areas, with our habitats as they relate to all sorts of animals, using squirrels as sort of a sentinel organism.
And one of the things you do is you compare the populations of gray squirrels and the population of fox squirrels in the Chicago region. And apparently the sort of the near western suburbs are like the line of battle between gray squirrels and fox squirrels, right?
Yeah, this is really neat because as many people have seen, gray squirrels are smaller than fox squirrels, but interestingly, they're a bit more aggressive. And however, where there are predators, the predators tend to hit the gray squirrels more frequently than the fox squirrels. And so in the suburbs, of course, you've got more coyotes, more hawks, things like this, more feral cats that are eating squirrels. And so you can oftentimes get a balance of squirrels. But then where the environment changes, maybe it's predator changes, maybe it's food source or shelter, number and size of trees. But as these parameters change, the populations will change. And we're seeing gray squirrels are tending to take over, but fox squirrels may be able to disperse back in. And by seeing this balance change, we can really see the battleground, not just between squirrels, but in a habitat that also supports beautiful little warblers and other, you know, tweety birds, and also nocturnal animals.
Very cool. So, Kay, talk to us a little bit about Project Budburst. What does Project Budburst do?
Well, Project Budburst is another citizen science campaign. Like Project Squirrel, we're national, and we're interested in a science of phenology. And phenology means the timing of natural events. So for plants, that might be when do they first leaf out, when do you see the first flower, when do they change color in the fall. And so we have citizen scientists all across the U.S. Recording that data for us. And this is particularly important because plants respond to climate change by changing their phenology. And so we can infer that the climate is changing if we're seeing them flowering early in the spring, for instance.
So this is the kind of thing that alert gardeners are keeping track of anyway.
Exactly. I mean, it's common sense to folks who garden a lot because, you know, they want the first tomato of the year, or they know when their daffodils bloom and when they bloomed the previous year. And so now they can go on Project Budburst website. It's very easy to participate.
And that's at projectbudburst.org, right?
It's www.budburst.org.
www.budburst.org. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And when you get on the website, you can register so that you can go back and do repeat observations, or you can submit data anonymously if you would like. You record your location where you're observing the plant species name, and we have about 75 species that we target, but you can put in, there's an other category, you can put in any plant that you happen to be watching, and then you just record what day did it open its first flower, and if you want to go back later in the year, what day was it in peak bloom, what day did you see the first fruit, what day did the leaves change color. So we'll take a single observation or multiple observations on the same plant or observations of multiple species.
Now, you know, in Chicago weather, as we have noticed today, there is a great deal of variation. Weather in the Midwest generally, the major characteristic of it is that it has a lot of extremes and it has a lot of variation. And probably that well, certainly in my garden, that affects the way the plants behave.
Absolutely.
So my question would be, with so much variation from year to year, how can you tell if there's climate change occurring? Or, you know, how can you sort out from all this crazy variation from year to year something that's useful?
Well, it takes a long time series, and Project Budburst is 4 years old now, and that's not really enough for us to say definitively climate is changing, because, like you said, there are these wild year-to-year variations. But we can use the data we're collecting and compare it to historical data, and over 40 or 50 years, looking at a long series of data like that, we can begin to see a signal that most of the plant species in Chicago are blooming earlier than they did, let's say, in the 50s or 60s. Some of them as much as a month earlier in the spring.
Wow. That's a really big difference, because I've been accustomed to telling people in my stories for years sort of what this historic average first frost date, what the historic average last frost date is. To try and guide people, for instance, when they can set their tomato plants out in the spring. But, you know, a month's difference is a big difference.
It is a serious difference, and we're not the only people who have been noticing this difference. The the Arbor Day Foundation did a USDA hardiness zone map comparison. Mm-hmm. And they compared to the typical hardiness zone map that was done based on climate averages over the last 50 years. And they took just the last 16 years of weather data and showed Chicago had warmed a hardiness zone, as had most of the U.S. Over half of the U.S. had warmed a hardiness zone.
So those of us who just can't stop ourselves from trying to plant things that are really supposed to be too tender for the Chicago area, we have a sliver of scientific support for this position?
Yeah, especially in a protected area, because we do have those flukes, those extremes still. But I have a Zone 7 shrub growing in my garden, and it's been there 15 years, and it's quite happy. And so, try some new things.
I've been actually astonished that I've been able to have hellebores. Mm-hmm. In my yard, which I had always thought were, of course, my yard is very sheltered. It's on the north side of a four-story building. It's a very urban site, and therefore it's very sort of sheltered. Mm-hmm. And But I had always thought that hellebores were too tender, but I've got some very happy hellebores in my yard.
As do I.
But you know, talking about the citizen science thing, you know, let's be honest. These are measurements that are not being taken under the most rigid scientific circumstances. You don't have somebody who got a National Science Foundation grant to go out and build a computer model and take the absolute meticulous, most careful scientific type measurements. You just have people in their backyards.
Right.
So are you really getting something, you know, about squirrels or about Project Budburst? Are you really getting something that's scientifically useful out of this?
Well, I believe we are. I think these observations are fairly straightforward to make. If you've correctly identified the plant, then you know, it's pretty easy to tell when a flower opens. And if there's a little bit of error in the data, the vast quantity of data we're getting, you know, the volume of data kind of overwhelms the occasional error. And we also have people who are ground truthing. So people like myself are going out and making observations, and then I compare that to other observations I see in the Chicago area, and we have people in other parts of the country doing that as well.
Yeah, we do the same thing in Project Squirrel, where the vast volume of observations that are coming in helps us if we have outliers or inaccuracies. Those kind of come out in the statistical wash. And then when we see consistently sort of odd things going on, we'll actually go to those sites and verify that. And more often than not, the weird things that are being reported are really true. And that's just one of those cool things that comes out of having so many participants in a scientific process.
And it's really easy to do. You can you just basically go to a website and then you go out in your backyard. And there are a number of these different citizen science efforts. I put a bunch of links to them in a post on my blog at growinginchicago.com, including Project Budburst and Project Squirrel. There's something called Monarch Watch, which keeps track of the migration of monarch butterflies.
We've had them on the show.
And yeah,
the Monarch
and
Watch.
There's also something called the. You want me to pronounce this now? I can't pronounce this, but it is the community rain, hail, and something or other. Network, which is a network of people who go out in their backyards every morning and check for rain and they check for snow, and they the Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network, which is at COCORAHS.org. And it if you try to pronounce it, it sounds like you're belching.
Sounds like Coco-Ra.
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 Like a really messed up kid cereal or something.
Yeah, something like that. And then, of course, the granddaddy of all of these citizen science things is the Audubon Society Christmas Bird Count, which has been going on for 100 years. They've been doing it since 1900, and that actually runs this year from December 14th to January 5th. You do have to, you know a little bit about birds in order to participate in that. You have to be able to tell, a cardinal from a sparrow. That's a highly organized effort, and I'm pretty sure that that has resulted in some pretty useful, pretty serious scientific data. And you can find more information about that at birds.audubon.org. Just in closing, I'm going to ask Kay, and then I'm going to ask Steve to tell us one really interesting thing that you've learned, Kay, from Project Budburst.
I think in comparing our data to historical data, learning the number of species that really are blooming much earlier in the spring has been fascinating and validates the trends that we kind of knew were happening, but we didn't have the data to show it.
Okay. And what about you?
one of the things that I was looking at on some of our maps the other day, as we plot where all the observations are, is it's clear that squirrels are spreading westward along the freeway system and just with sort of westward development. And it makes sense, you know, when you get into Colorado and you have that short grass prairie, but you have somebody move there and establish a house or a town and you start planting trees, and shortly thereafter the squirrels move in. And so we are seeing squirrels starting to cross the Rockies through natural dispersal. We've also got squirrels from the Midwest that have been human transplanted into places like California and things like that. And it's just, it's really interesting to see both natural and artificial distribution of squirrels as they're changing. And what we're really looking forward to is getting more observers in Montana and Idaho and the Dakotas so that we can really quantify some of these dispersals a little more effectively.
So if anybody has relatives in the Mountain West,
yeah,
you should encourage them to look up Project Squirrel and get in on this this whole citizen science thing and become a scientist right in their backyard. This is the Mike Novak Show on WCPT 820 AM, Chicago's Progressive Talk. I am, I think, pretty obviously not Mike Novak. This is Beth Botts. I'm substituting for Mike today because Mike is doing some Christmas caroling up at the Chicago Botanic Garden with the caroling group called the Frozen Robins. And if they're caroling outside today, they will indeed be frozen. It's really grim out there. And if you are listening to the Mike Novak Show on the radio in your car, I would strongly suggest that you slow down and be really, really careful and turn your headlights on. And really take it easy today because, as Rick DeMaio told us earlier, we're having probably about the worst kind of weather you can get in Chicago today. If we don't have blizzard conditions already, we're headed for blizzard conditions. So thanks a lot, Kay. Thanks, Steve. And I want to talk to you a little bit, or Heather wants to talk to you a little bit about SIDS,
mm-hmm.
which is one of the sponsors of the Mike Novak Show.
Oh, yes, they are.
And
if I could get them, it's not going to work. Ah, they ain't that just the way it goes.
This is our intrepid producer here, Heather Fry.
I was going to have a nice Christmas bed under the second reed, some nice instrumental Christmas music, but it doesn't want to work. So, that's... because it's just about 12 days of Christmas away. So you'd better make that list and check it at least twice and then count on the folks at SIDS Greenhouses and Garden Center to help you get through it with great gifts, plus home and party decor. Everyone's been disappointed with a discount store poinsettia, so this year be sure to get a real florist quality poinsettia from SIDS Greenhouses. They deliver throughout the entire Chicagoland area, and in addition to poinsettias, they also have the best custom-made to order floral gifts in Chicago and Chicagoland, and so much more. So get your list of family, friends, and business associates together. Call SIDS tomorrow, and it's done. SIDS can help with plenty of home and party decorating. Fresh Christmas centerpieces will add a special touch to your holiday table. Plus, SIDS' entire stock of lifelike Christmas trees, decorations, and ornaments is 50 to 75% off. So outside of the weather, I don't know what's stopping you. Fresh cut trees, wreaths, garland are still available, and they're real. And the real eco-friendly alternative for holiday decorating. SIDS, Chicagoland's premier garden centers, are located in Palos Hills on Southwest Highway and in Bolingbrook on Napier Plainfield Road at Hassert Boulevard.
Housing investment that can pay big dividends? Remodel your kitchen or bathroom. You'll freshen up your home and add value to it, too.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for all your remodeling needs. Kitchens, bathrooms, master suites, and more. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
Are you familiar with Aldo Leopold? He's considered the father of wildlife ecology and a great figure in the history of conservation in the Midwest. WRD Environmental would like you to remember something that Aldo Leopold wrote. He said, "The outstanding scientific discovery of the 20th century is not television or radio, but rather the complexity of the land organism. Only those who know the most about it can appreciate how little we know about it. The last word in ignorance is the man who says of an animal or plant, what good is it? If the land mechanism as a whole is not good, is good, then every part is good, whether we understand it or not. If the biota, in the course of eons, has built something we like but do not understand, then who but a fool would discard seemingly useless parts? To keep every cog and wheel is the first precaution of intelligent tinkering." At WRD Environmental, they not only appreciate the complexity of our region's ecology, but are dedicated to protecting, restoring, and healing it. WRD creates sustainable landscapes from large-scale master planning to community pocket parks. For innovative, sustainable landscape development, choose WRD Environmental, located at the Chicago Center for Green Technology and online at WRDEnvironmental.com. So, this is Beth Bott sitting in for Mike Novak on Chicago's Progressive Talk, WCPT, 820 AM. We have, looks like, one more question about squirrels from Bernie in Chicago. A question about black squirrels.
Right. I've seen them along, that western edge of Lake Michigan in Michigan when you go through Holland, you know, along the western shore of Michigan.
Sure.
And then that's one question, and I got another one. But
well, yeah.
And then Davenport, Iowa. Black squirrels.
Right.
Where did they come from?
Yeah, black squirrels are what we call a morph of gray squirrel. And that is, you know, you've got blondes and brunettes, and same thing in the gray squirrel species. And black squirrels historically were widespread throughout the United States, although in the northern parts they were a little more common, simply because with that black fur, they could stay just the tiniest bit warmer during the winter, and so they would tend to survive just a little bit. But squirrel meat, of course, for much of our nation's history, it was a very important food source for people, and black squirrels aren't quite as camouflaged as gray squirrels, so they're a little bit easier for us to shoot and put in the pot. Black squirrels have quite an interesting history of dispersal because, of course, that gene occurs in the population anyway. And so most of the black squirrels that we see along the shores of Lake Michigan, up in the Detroit area, and even here in, especially in North Chicago or the northern parts of Chicago, it seems like we have a lot of black squirrels. Those are naturally occurring individuals that just happen to have really dark hair. However, because black squirrels are so pretty, they have oftentimes been trapped and moved to places and then they escape. So black squirrels in places like Washington, D.C. are actually transplants that were put there for the zoo and then escaped and now are reproducing at elevated numbers. And the ones in Davenport, I think, have just a natural origin. But we are seeing an increase in black squirrels sort of nationwide, and it's not like all the gray squirrels are going to turn black, but people see them pretty frequently these days.
Okay, one more question.
Sure.
Okay, I think I got them in my attic here.
This is the other squirrel issue that was bound to come up.
Right, and they come out of the attic when I'm gone for 3 or 4 days because I see those little nuts in the drawers.
Oh.
Or even in my vacuum cleaner hose, it was just loaded with these little acorns or whatever they come out of the trees.
Weird.
Now, if I capture them, I have to find out where they're coming in from.
Right.
But if I capture them, how far should I remove them?
Well, this gets into sort of an interesting Aldo Leopold-esque answer here, if we can refer back to that wonderful professor. It's very odd that you're finding nuts actually cached in drawers and vacuum hoses. And these are acorns that you're finding?
Yeah, the little nuts that come out of the oak trees.
Yeah, sure. Okay, and do you live in the northern part of the state or closer to Chicago?
LaPorte County.
Okay, interesting. Sometimes red squirrels, which are not fox squirrels, red squirrels are smaller than even gray squirrels, with kind of a clean white belly and a chestnut back with a black racing stripe. Sometimes they will cache like that. Have you seen red squirrels around?
Oh yeah, they're both here.
Right. So that's what you've got going. Gray squirrels and fox squirrels, and sometimes in the Midwest we call fox squirrels red squirrels, which just causes all sorts of confusion. But the ones with the white bellies and the ones with the rusty bellies are scatter hoarders. They'll scatter their nuts just wherever, all over your yard. But red squirrels, those little guys with the white eye rings and the white bellies, are larder hoarders. And so they'll just stash stuff, like you're saying, they'll fill your vacuum or something, and then they'll try to defend that, even from black bears. And so... They can get in very tiny holes. A hole the size of a quarter would not be unheard of for them to squeeze through. And one thing that you can do is just stuff some wadded up newspaper in any holes that you find, and if it gets knocked out, then sure enough, you know that's where the squirrels are coming through.
Hmm.
The touchy part of the answer then becomes how far to release them. Now, you know, I am a squirrel lover, I'm a cat lover, I'm a deer lover, but I am also a conservation biologist. And what that means is I want all of these species to be around all the time, and I want them to be in an appropriate balance. And sometimes that means killing individual animals, and that can be rough sometimes. I generally don't advocate actually transporting an animal from one site and letting it go somewhere else, because... Of course, when you go to another forest preserve and let an animal go, if we look at forest preserve resources like houses, apartments, grocery stores, and watering holes, usually all of those resources are taken up by all the animals that are already living there. And so if we release another animal, we have potential fights, starvation, predation, and even the transmission of disease. So typically what I say is when you've got a rodent species like this, it reproduces really well. Eliminating an individual from the population is not going to affect the long-term health of the population. It's probably best just to humanely euthanize these things.
So call in an animal control firm, a company that deals with this, and they'll be able to figure out how to get the squirrels out of there and how to plug up the holes where the squirrels are getting in.
And the other thing is these are game animals, and so sometimes there are state regulations that determine how and when you can trap things.
Yeah, so it's best to deal with a professional on this.
So what you're saying is don't give them names.
Yeah. I think the general gist of it is don't give them names. But thanks a lot. We really appreciate
your
calling in. And we have one last squirrel question, and this is going to be the last question. The question is, what do squirrels taste like? Chicken?
You know, I got to say, the squirrel tastes like squirrel. rabbit tastes like rabbit. And for anybody that does have other questions, too, feel free to go to projectsquirrel.org, and we will answer all sorts of questions. You can find the Contact Us button. But squirrels are an excellent game resource, and they're a great way to encourage people to get outside, whether they actually want to hunt them and eat them, simply watch them, or enjoy the products of squirrel labor, like hickory trees and all of the animals that are attracted to hickory trees. They're really one of our keystone species in both the urban and the rural ecosystems.
Yeah, we really depend on squirrels, actually, to lose nuts all over the place. So that we could get so many of the wonderful trees that we enjoy. So thanks a lot, Steve. That was Steve Sullivan, the curator of urban ecology at the Peggy Notabart Nature Museum. We also heard from Kay Havens, who's from Project Budburst. She's up at the Chicago Botanic Garden. And now I'd like to talk to Sean Kingzett, who's with the Care of Trees. Are you there, Sean?
Good morning, Beth. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Great show, by the way. I'm well.
Good. I'm glad. So the reason we asked you to come on to this is the Mike Novak show, incidentally. I'm not Mike Novak. I'm Beth Botts. I'm subbing for Mike Novak here on WCPT at 8:20 a.m. And Sean, what we wanted to talk to you about was a couple of things. One is this whole issue of live Christmas trees. A lot of people at this time of year are thinking, oh, it's so wasteful for me to get a Christmas tree and bring it into my house and decorate it and then you know, just discard it.
Throw it away. Yep.
Throw it away. And so they think, well, what if I got a live Christmas tree and then I actually planted it in my garden after the Christmas season?
Great idea. Great concept, isn't it?
It's a great concept. It sounds great. So tell me about how it actually works out.
Well, there's a couple of challenges around that. And one is our climate. It's not the easiest thing to do to dig a hole in this kind of weather, a blizzard, you know, on January 8th or whatever. Do you really want to be going out and digging a hole? So you have to have some planning in mind. If you are going to do this, you have to pre-dig your hole. There's also challenges with getting that tree to survive in that type of condition. Evergreens are evergreen, but they are not doing photosynthesis in the winter. They are still dormant. And so you bring them out of the cold, out of their dormancy. You bring them inside in your 70-degree house, and those needles start to lose water and start to come out of dormancy, and the tree starts to take up water. And it starts to do its spring thing, and now you have to take that tree out of this nice, warm environment that you've had it in and take it back outside into that cold, and that is very damaging. It's very difficult to get that tree to survive that move. So in our area, it's not necessarily a good idea to do that.
And the other issue about the live Christmas tree is that you may not want to plant an evergreen in your yard every year. Because you could end up with basically a Christmas tree farm in your yard, right?
Yeah. Now, unless you have some space, there's not a lot of evergreens that are well-suited for the Midwest. There's not really a lot of native evergreen trees to our area. White pine is native, Doug fir. You know, a lot of our evergreen trees are really more of a northern species, and they do just barely dip down this far south. But not a lot of them are well-suited, especially for an urban, suburban, typical backyard. Most people don't have enough room for a lot of evergreen trees. So you might be able to do that one year. If you can get the tree to survive being moved inside and then back outside, you know, over the long haul, you're not going to have a room for a lot of evergreen trees in your yard.
Yeah, you see a lot of homes in Chicago where somebody planted some, you know, really cute little spruce tree 50 years ago, and now there's this like immense 70 foot tall tree that is taking over the front yard, and it looks like it's about to eat the house.
That's kind of a risk
because that when we buy a Christmas tree at the Christmas tree lot, we're buying a very young tree.
Yeah, 6 foot tall, 7 foot tall, 8 foot tall. And you have to project out into the future and realize that over the long haul, that tree is just going to usually get much too large for the space that it's being planted in. That's what you see with these 70-year-old, 50-year-old spruce trees is they just don't take over the whole yard. Whether they're a Christmas tree or not, a lot of the evergreen trees inevitably end up too big for the space they're being planted into.
And the city of Chicago holds a contest for which is going to be the city's Christmas tree, and you enter your 70-foot tall Christmas tree to be the Christmas tree for the whole city.
So that is an ultimate renewable resource there, right? It takes 50 years to get the city's Christmas tree.
There you go. But you're contributing to the greater good.
Inevitably. Of course, it's 1 in 100, right?
Right,
one
exactly.
In 1,000 spruce
exactly.
Trees.
And the other thing that about these live Christmas trees is that I think you got to think about is that the tree itself is going to be tremendously heavy. Even you know, 3 or 4 foot tall tree with its root ball is going to be a couple hundred pounds, right?
Yeah, and the scale, you have this large root ball. You know, so half of your, unless you have very tall ceilings, you know, half the tree is going to be, or a third of the tree will be the root ball itself. Usually when you're buying these things, you don't really get a 6 foot tall tree. You get a 4 foot tall tree because two of it is taken up in the depth of the height of the root ball. So yeah, just this canvas that you can't really decorate. You know, it really doesn't necessarily look as nice as the typical Christmas tree. That's another issue. Is the way that they prune Christmas trees is fine if you're hanging ornaments, but from an arborist perspective, it's not really, you don't really want to shape a typical evergreen tree, a spruce tree, a fir tree. You don't really want to shape them in your landscape. So oftentimes when you've shaped it for the purposes of a Christmas tree, now you plant that into the landscape. It takes a little bit of work to get that tree back in form, to get it looking like a fir tree is supposed to look, or looking like a pine tree is supposed to look, instead of the sculpted, shaped it, sort of forced plant, if that makes sense.
Yeah. You're not going to have a very natural-looking tree in your yard after it was a Christmas tree.
Yeah, for several years. It's going to have to grow out of that shearing that they do to make it look like a Christmas tree.
Okay, so it's not that you can't do this, because you can do this, and there are people who have done it.
Yeah, oh no, you can. I've planted plants in January. I've gotten free plants in my garden before, and ones that are actually difficult to work with, rhododendron. Mm-hmm. I've gotten free rhododendrons, but the caveat was that I was out digging holes on January 15th. So it can be done. It's not that it can't be successful, but there are challenges around it.
Yeah, it would need to be one of those warm years when the ground doesn't really freeze that much, or else you dug the hole in October.
No, I was out chipping away through frozen ground to get to the. I think that year that I did that, the ground was frozen to about 4 or 6 inches. So once I pickaxed through that, then I got to softer soil. But yeah, I looked like a fool to my neighbors pretty much. So
yeah. And we're going to come back and talk about what you can do with your Christmas tree. But first, I want to talk about Grand Street Gardens. The snow and the cold keep coming. So maybe on a day like today, you might want to get away to someplace tropical. Or if you can't manage that, pick up a tropical plant variety to warm up your home at Grand Street Gardens in Chicago. They are 30% off this week, and wouldn't that be a great Christmas present for somebody? Grand Street Gardens is stocked with pre-made holiday arrangements, along with Fraser and balsam firs, and tree stands are 30% off, too. So make your home grand for the holidays at Grand Street Gardens, open from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. during the week and from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on the weekends, and located at 2200 West Grand Avenue. That's 2200 West Grand Avenue in Ukrainian Village.
Hey, gardeners. Want to be inspired? Make plans to visit Cantini Gardens in Wheaton, the 500-acre former estate of Robert R. McCormick. Cantini isn't just beautiful, it's a horticultural masterpiece. Stroll through the spectacular formal gardens created by renowned landscape architect Franz Lipp and marvel at the sheer variety of annuals, perennials, ground covers, trees, and shrubs. You'll love Cantini's Idea Garden, Rose Garden, and Native Prairie, too. Cantini has something for everyone, including museums, picnic area, gift shop, and restaurants. Plan your visit today at cantini.org.
Here's a tip from the Care of Trees. Actually, it's several ways that they give back to the Chicagoland community. They support organizations like the Open Lands Tree Keepers. The Care of Trees shows up for every course and teaches average citizens how to make the urban forest healthier. The Care of Trees also works with the City of Chicago Department of the Environment's Green Corps, a job training green industry program which is run out of the Center for Green Technology. The Care of Trees speaks to garden clubs and teaches their members how to preserve the greatest plants on the planet. These are just three reasons why you should make the Care of Trees your permanent partner in enhancing the value of your landscape. Whether you want to make sure all is well with the trees in your yard, you're changing your landscaping, or you're moving, invite the certified arborists at the Care of Trees to take a look. See thecareoftrees.com or call 847-394-4220. That's 847-394-4220. The Care of Trees. Their business is people and their love for trees.
sitting in for Mike Novak on the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk at 8:20 a.m. in Chicago. And we're talking to Sean Kingsett from the Care of Trees. And we've talked about some of the challenges involved in having a live Christmas tree. So what if we say, okay, that's just too much trouble, and we are gonna go someplace and we're gonna get a nice, beautiful farmed Christmas tree, and now it's December 26th or maybe it's January 1st, and now what, Sean?
Now throw that thing away before it starts dropping needles all over your house. No, once you got in there and you've cut the end off and you've got it watered and you know you've enjoyed it through the season, there's still some use that can be gained out of that tree. And actually, first off, I don't know that, you know, Christmas trees are a renewable resource. There's people that are using the land, agriculturally to grow this crop. And in terms of crops, I think it is a crop that adds some benefit back to the environment. It is a habitat of sorts. Not a great habitat, not a very diverse habitat, but I think that where Christmas tree farms are, it's still a useful way to use the land if you're going to be using the land for production, if that makes sense. I don't think it is the most wasteful way to grow something. Yeah, you're cutting them down and you have to grow them again, but it is renewable.
Well, and in a natural forest, you would have trees at various stages of life anyway.
Correct, yeah. Again, you don't have a mature evergreen woods, but you do have an ecosystem of sorts. And it does have some value to the environment. It's not useless land. So more useful than a soybean field, for certain.
Okay.
But now that you're done with your tree, there are some useful things you can do with it to extend its benefit. You can put it out into your landscape still, prop it up so that it's secure, and you could use it for a bird feeder. You can take pine cones and peanut butter and bird food and use it to attract birds for the rest of the season, your nuthatches, your chickadees, cardinals, things of this sort that would be attracted to that. So you can extend the useful life of that. It'll stay green. You can cut off the branches. You can put that into your beds to help keep your beds. Some of your perennials that maybe are a little soft, maybe as your previous conversation about plants that have come up a little too early, if you cover that bed up with the boughs from, cut the boughs off from the tree and cover your beds up, you can use that to protect those maybe slightly soft plants that you're concerned come up too early and might get damaged by frost. You can also use it for outdoor fireplaces, but not for indoor. The sap, the resins that are in fir trees and evergreen trees will clog the flue of your fireplace. So do not use it in indoor fireplaces. But if you have, that's what actually what I tend to do with mine. Is, I have a little outdoor fire pit that I use in the summer, and I just use the boughs to get my fire started, and then I just burn up my logs as I need them. I don't only use that, but that's sort of how I recycle my tree. And then the most common form of recycling is actually just to have it chipped up. Wood chips, taking it to your local recycling center or if your village collects them, they tend to chip them, and that turns into wood chips that then can be put back into landscape use and has a great benefit as well.
And Steve has just told me that there's information about this at recycle@naturemuseum.org. Am I right about that?
The city sets up a Christmas tree recycling center at the Nature Museum. So you can just bring your Christmas tree over there, drop it off, and we take care of the rest. We chip them up and use the mulch, and you can get certain days, at least historically, they'll chip it and you can take a bag of mulch back with you.
Yeah, the city of Chicago has set up its Christmas tree collection from January 1st to January 17th. And what I'm told is the trees will be chipped and made into mulch, which will be available for pickup by gardeners starting Friday, January 7th at the same sites. In order to find out where you can take your Christmas tree, you need to call 312-744-7606. You could also try the City of Chicago website, or you could call 311 to try and find out about that. And in various suburbs, you should probably call your village hall and find out exactly what the deal is on recycling the Christmas trees. I will tell you about my experience in Oak Park, where I live. First of all, there's a great deal of confusion about whether you take the Christmas tree out to the curb or whether you put it in the alley. And sometimes we have Christmas trees that are still sitting out on the parkway until March because somebody thought that the city was going to come and pick up trees from the parkway. So I would make sure that you get perfectly clear with your village about exactly where you are supposed to put the Christmas tree. The other thing, Sean, is I wanted to talk to you about this. For several years, I did the thing where you cut the boughs off the Christmas tree and you lay it over the beds to protect the plants. Here's my tip. This is the Beth Botts tip about Christmas trees. If you live in an apartment and you're done with your Christmas tree, it is a whole lot easier to take your loppers and dismember the Christmas tree in your living room and carry it downstairs in pieces than it is to try dragging an entire dried-out Christmas tree down three flights of stairs. Trust me.
Needles falling off and vacuuming for the next 4 months? Yeah. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Now, my problem with using the Christmas tree boughs as mulch in my beds is that the needles fell off. Two things happened. First of all, I didn't even notice that the snowdrops were blooming underneath my Christmas tree boughs. So here I had snowdrops in my beds, and I was missing them because I had covered them up with Christmas tree boughs. So that was a problem. The other problem is I would take the boughs off the perennial beds when I realized they were covering up the snowdrops, and I would fling them under this yew hedge that we had. And I got this like accumulation of sticks under the yew hedge because the needles fell off, but the branches, you know, were not going to decay anytime soon. And what I eventually realized was I was going to have to take all those strips, all of those sticks from the evergreen boughs, bundle them up, and pay for them to be hauled away as landscape waste.
For convenience, I think, unless you have some space, I think for convenience, the chipping disposal is the easiest route to go. What I've done in the past when I've used those boughs that way, either as decoration or to protect the bed, is then I put those into my compost bin. When you have a lot of green, soft vegetative matter to add more carbon,
right.
I find that the twigs actually help my compost bin. Now, I do break them up to smaller sizes to help that decomposition process, but to add you are correct. The breakdown of the evergreen wood is not very quick, but sometimes that's a benefit. So when I get that into my compost bin, it helps my compost be a little bit more complex versus just the quick things that biodegrade very rapidly.
And it'll help if you just take your pruners and cut it up into
pieces. Cut it up into smaller pieces, yeah, make it more. The organisms that break it down, they need the surface area. So the smaller pieces you cut it up into, the quicker that breaks down.
Okay, great. Well, listen, thanks, Sean. That's Sean Kingsett from the Care of Trees, and he's here talking to us about Christmas trees. Want to say just a couple of things, mention a few things before we have to sign off here. The Wicker Park Garden Club is starting a lecture series in January on important contemporary landscape architects. This is very high-level landscape design at the Wicker Park Garden Club. If you're not aware of the Wicker Park Garden Club, that's a great resource for garden classes and garden information in the city, in urban sites. All the garden clubs are very useful. If you live out in the suburbs, call around and find your local garden club, and you'll find people who have been gardening in your area for a long time, and they are a really great resource for information, especially if you're just getting started. These Wicker Park lectures are going to be at a pretty high level, a pretty haute garden design. They start January 10th. You can find more information at wpgarden.org. If you're just getting started as a gardener, especially as a vegetable gardener, it's a really good idea to check out the Open Lands Bugs classes. That is the Building Urban Gardens classes. They're going to start on January 29th for 8 weeks. I believe that the Garfield Park Conservatory, and I took that class, boy, it must be 10 years ago now, a really good introduction to urban gardening. You can find out more about that at openlands.org. And I would like to thank all the guests who've been on the show today. We had Gene Bragdon from Lurvie's Garden Center in Des Plaines talking about houseplants. We've got Steve Sullivan here from the Peggy Notabart Nature Museum in Lincoln Park. He's the curator of urban ecology there and runs Project Squirrel. You can find information about Project Squirrel at projectsquirrel.org. We had Kay Havens from the Chicago Botanic Garden from Project Budburst. You can find out more about that at budburst.org. These links are all, incidentally, on my blog at growinginchicago.com. We also had our intrepid producer, Heather Fry.
Oh, thanks.
Who has been dancing across the keyboard over here, or the what do we call this thing?
This is a control board.
The control board.
Heather has a console.
The console. Heather is in control of the control board.
I like being in control. Mike should be out more often.
Yeah, you think so?
You probably heard that too and just skidded on the road. Like, oh, I'll get her.
Yeah. So, once again, this is Beth Botts. I'm sitting in for Mike Novak on the Mike Novak Show here on WCPT. It's been fun. And thank you all for Twittering. Thank you all for calling in with your squirrel questions and your houseplant questions and all your other questions. Mike will be back next week.
Yes, and we're doing our, it's a slice. It's a wonderful slice. We'll
it's
be done.
It's a wonderful slice.
Live next week with Mike and I. So a holiday tradition of the Mike Novak Show will be right here next week. And if you, they still have the podcast up from last year's, I believe, on his webpage, which is mikenovak.net. But tune in live next week.
And that is mikenovak.net with a W.
Yes.
With a W. And then I will just mention a couple of things. I'm going to be speaking January 22nd at the Porter County Garden Show in Valparaiso, Indiana. You can see pcgarden.info for more information. And I thank you all for tuning in here on this snowy and blizzardy Chicago day. We're signing off now on the Mike Novak Show.
Yep, we got to be safe out there. Remember, if you need more about the forecast, you can go to www.demayoweather.com, which is also on Mike's website, www.mikenovak.net. Be safe out there. Go Bears.
Like, go Bears.
Yeah,
go Bears.
That's what I love. They got to play in the elements, you know?
They got to play in the elements.
Exactly.
This is, you know, football is supposed to be about being tough.
Yeah.
You know,
if you
don't, and
if
this
you
is, today is the
get
day.
Get a dome, you're big sissy.
A dome. Yeah.
Unless
a
you're
dome.
Minnesota and it collapses on you. I keep wondering, is Favre running around? The sky is falling. The sky is falling.
Well, the sky kind of more or less is falling
in
today.
A way.
Yeah. Yeah. Or at least all the moisture in the sky is falling today.
Right.
So anyway.
But for the Mike Novak Show, we just want to say thank you to Beth for coming in again and being awesome. And we want to say go green or go home.